need to pull up. Okay. So today I'm going to talk to you about the findings from a community-based case study that we did and sort of explore this concept that we've come up with of geobehavioral vulnerability. First, I want to acknowledge the work was funded by a pilot project from the National Institute of Mental Health through an R25 at Yale University. So to think about the background, in Philadelphia, we have a city that's a city of neighborhoods, but then within those neighborhoods, prevalence rates vary significantly among neighboring communities. So you can have one census tract that has a prevalence rate of zero, and then right next to it, it could be as high as 668 per 10,000. Black Philadelphians account for almost two-thirds of all Philadelphians that are living with HIV/AIDS, and 70% of our new HIV infections. GIS mapping shows that the way that HIV is concentrated within communities is even different within census tracts. So you almost have like core clusters within tracts. And as many of you in this room know, we really can no longer just focus on individual level behavior, but there are things at the social and structural levels that are driving the epidemic. In the notion of geobehavioral vulnerability, we see it that it's not just what someone does, but where they do it and with whom. So if you live in an environment where no one else has HIV, then what is your HIV risk? Zero, because the virus just simply isn't there. So it's not that you're using condoms more or you have fewer sexual partners, but it's the nature of the risk environment that you live in. So as we look at these multi-level inequities, things like concentrated disadvantage, the hyper-incarceration of African-American men or black men, and then the constraints on sexual networks where people will be more likely to have sexual partners in their geographic environment or more likely to have sexual partners from a particular social network. If your geography and your social network then are highly concentrated with the HIV virus, the risk will be higher for those persons. So our study, again, was to look at a comparative neighborhood-based model using a multi-method approach, as well as looking at individual social and structural factors that were contributing to the HIV epidemic among Black Philadelphians. There were three primary methods. We held a focus group with administrators, direct service providers, and community experts who lived in one of the neighborhoods with the highest HIV incidence rates. We did electronic surveys with individuals who also resided there to get at the demographics, some of the behaviors that they were engaging in, as well as their perceptions of their neighborhood, because we had access to secondary level data within each census tract, but we wanted to know what the community's perception was of their neighborhood or their census tract. And then we did a community level ethnography. So for the study, we had four particular tracts that we focused on and spent some time in. This table here shows the four communities that we were in compared to the city of Philadelphia as a whole. And what we did, we stratified by race, so either predominantly black or predominantly white, and that was defined by greater than 85% black or white residents, and then whether they had high or low HIV incidence or prevalence. So we ended up with the four communities ranging from predominantly black population with high HIV prevalence to predominantly white population with low HIV prevalence. So we love this one here. We called it Ethnography in the City. And as I said, we went into each of the four neighborhoods. We spent about 2 weeks per neighborhood, which for those of you in the room who are true ethnographers, that was a condensed amount of time, but with the constraints for the grant, that was about the amount of time that we had to be in each neighborhood. But we were able to uncover a lot of really interesting information that we'll be applying for a grant in January to go back in to collect more and to partner with the community for a more extended period of time. So the first community that we'll look at, Community D, was a predominantly white community that had high HIV incidence. Within the city, it's called and referred to as the Gayborhood, so that was not me as the researcher putting that label on the slide. I want to put that out there up front. But this area, surprisingly, there were a lot of health centers that were present. There was a farmer's market, so there was access to fresh produce. You know, some of the structural things that we would think would not be in place were there in this neighborhood. A lot of social entertainment. Several private health care providers' offices were there, so the health resources were in this neighborhood. You know, and in theory, as we feel that the virus follows racial and ethnic trends, Community D was very interesting because it contradicted what we think a neighborhood that has high HIV prevalence would look like or high HIV incidence. Community C, on the other hand, was predominantly white with a low HIV incidence. So when we started looking at some of the social and structural things in this neighborhood, there were very low crime rates, the housing was very opulent, the properties were upkept, there was food security, so you had a lot of supermarkets, a lot of fresh produce, again, in the area. This particular section of the city is predominantly Italian. There's also a large Irish population when we look at the subgroups within, you know, the entire Caucasian racial ethnic category, and the residents did not perceive that HIV was an issue in this neighborhood. In Community D, people who lived and worked in that neighborhood kind of felt that HIV rates might be high, but in this one, they felt that HIV was not an issue for anyone that lived in the neighborhood. Community B was a predominantly black neighborhood with high HIV incidence. One of the things that really came up that was interesting here was the phenomenon that the residents called the corner house issue, where people who lived on the corners, their houses were targeted either for drug use, trading sex for money, because they had stairwells where you could go down and not be visible from the street level. So this particular property here, I'm not sure if you can see from the picture, but there, you know, people would frequently litter on that property, or we got to speak to a woman who lived there. She said in the middle of the night she could hear people having sex outside of her window and then would come out and find condoms in those locations. So there definitely was more talk of commercial sex work in this area, higher crime rates. A lot of churches were present, but not as many of some of the other social institutions that we might think of, so our healthcare providers, primary care practices. No aid service organizations were in this area at all, but some people did have their staff come into the community to do outreach. And there were a lot of abandoned and dilapidated buildings and structures. Then Community A, again, is another one that was contrary to what we might typically think if we think of a predominantly black neighborhood where, again, looking at racial and ethnic lines, you might expect that HIV rates would be high, but this was a neighborhood where HIV incidence was low. Prostitution and commercial sex work was still an issue here. There's a large arboretum that is like a beautiful green space, but residents were saying that they also noticed that people were there selling drugs, trading sex for money, and engaging in other activities. There was more upkeep of the properties in this neighborhood, so you could see that the neighbors, and one of the gentlemen that we interacted with was saying that sort of the neighbors kind of hold each other accountable. If your grass isn't cut or if you have trash in front of your home, somebody might be more apt to say something to you. One of the other pieces, as I mentioned, we did a focus group with the key stakeholders, and we wanted, in their opinions, to learn what they thought were some of the things that were driving the epidemic that we saw in our city. And so we targeted people specifically who either lived, worked, or had a vested interest in this one particular neighborhood that had the city's highest HIV incidence and prevalence rates. To look at their demographics, majority were female. On average, they were about 31 years old. 90% self-identified as black or African American. Most had either finished trade school or had a four-year degree or some postgraduate education, and 90% were currently employed. One of the most interesting things that we found came out of this was that unanimously the group believed that eradicating HIV was impossible, which was really interesting for us because 6 of the 10 worked in the HIV field. But according to them, they were saying, one, there's way too many people in the world who are currently living with the virus to do anything about it. And then two, we've created an economy based on this issue. So even if we want to get away from HIV, this is how people are earning their income. This is how pharmaceutical companies, you know, are making money. So they saw the disease itself as more of a business than something that the world was really working together to try to do away with. and thinking about some strategies to mobilize the Philadelphia community and whether or not the environment was ready. They were very much in favor of biological prevention. They felt that maybe microbicides, gel, some of the other biobehavioral areas that we're moving in might be more effective than just condoms alone. They thought that sexual health courses would be important to deliver at the community level. There was also a very strong sense that they didn't, again, want to see things just targeted towards individual, but looking at policies and structures that were in place, as well as getting communities involved around the issue. Similar to what we've seen with community members as well, the notion of getting celebrities involved, having somebody that people look up to or respect or want to be like, and then having them speak on the issue. For the questionnaire pilot, we implemented a one-hour electronic questionnaire with people who self-identified as Black and then again lived in this neighborhood that had the highest HIV incidence. And for their demographics, the sample was predominantly male, about half male. We did have a transgender woman participate. On average, their age was 40. And education-wise, about 46% had a high school diploma or less. And they had worked an average of 2 jobs. And when we see for the number of jobs they worked and for the type of education that they had, almost 2/3 of the sample made less than $40,000 a year, and they had an average of 3 children. So it kind of gives a sense of the socio-demographic group that we were working with. We asked them questions again on their perceptions about their neighborhood. Majority had positive feelings toward their neighborhood, that they liked it, they were comfortable with the area they lived in. We also did a focus group with them after they took the questionnaire to kind of get their feedback on the questions we asked and see if there was anything else that they wanted to add. But they did feel that their neighborhoods were a bright place to live, that they enjoyed living there, but they were concerned about safety that was in their neighborhoods and whether or not they were comfortable with the police presence that they had. And all about majority of them believed that either commercial sex work or drug use was a problem in their neighborhoods. And looking at sexual behaviors, I've included the ranges because as you'll notice, the standard deviations are really broad for the categories. We did have a couple of participants who stated that they were engaging in commercial sex work. So we had some people who, you know, let's say for oral sex, had up to 100 partners in their lifetime. So that throws some of the numbers off. Majority had oral sex and vaginal sex. One of the things that we did get that ties into a previous presentation was the concept of having sex with partners after they were released from prison, because maybe their partner was negative before incarceration, acquired the virus while they were there, and we see that 30% of the sample had partners who had been incarcerated, and then almost 86% had sex with their partners after release. And then in looking at that, on average, they had 21 times of having sex with someone who was released from prison, without using a condom. In STI testing, we had 91% of the sample had ever been tested for an STI, and they pretty much got tested on a regular basis. In the discussion, they were saying that they looked at it as something that was part of their regular routine health care that they wanted to do continually. Most of them were being tested in either a health center or a clinic. We did have 2 individuals who went to the emergency room. And when looking at reasons not to be tested in their neighborhood, they didn't want people to know that they had been tested or, you know, were tested positive for an STI. And then in their decision to get tested, majority were tested because signs or symptoms were present, which I think for us in public health, we want people to be tested before they have a sign or a symptom or to do it as a routine part of their care. And then we had on average, they tested positive for an STI 2 times in their lifetimes. The most common diagnoses when they were tested were either herpes or BV. 80% who tested positive reported that they received treatment, and then again, most of them received treatment in the health center or clinic. And looking at their sexual partners, one of the things that I wanted to point out here was that 55% indicated that their sexual partners live nearby. So again, if you live in an area that has high HIV incidence or high HIV concentration, and you're more likely to have sexual partners in that area, you may be more likely to be exposed to the virus. The other thing, looking at whether or not they agreed that most of their sexual partners were from their same race or ethnicity, majority agreed or were in the middle on that. And then they met their sexual partners either through friends or family members, but then other people talked a lot about just being outside, walking to the supermarket, online was another thing that came up, meeting people in chat rooms. So those are other areas where we can think about possibly intervening. 91%, which we were very happy about, had ever been tested for HIV, and again, that was something that they were including as a routine part of their care or their practice. But again, a sign or a symptom was what prompted them to be tested, not necessarily thinking about it as routine care or because it was offered. Mental health, we had 18% who had ever been diagnosed, and of those who were diagnosed, they were receiving treatment. One person was taking medication. And I apologize, I'm rushing, but I got the 1 minute sign. Drug and substance abuse was also reported in the sample. We had two individuals who had ever used crack cocaine and one person who had used heroin. And again, when we think about environments, if it's available, if it's there, and people can access it, that might be another area that we would have to intervene, knowing the relationship between substance use and HIV risk. Majority of them had their regular health appointments through private practice, or about 50%. And then again, they were seeing their providers on a frequent or a regular basis, and they felt that they could talk to their providers about issues that were important to them, which kind of contradicts a lot of what we see or what we would think, that there's this barrier that's there, they're not going to speak to their providers, but some of the members of this sample did have good relationships with their providers. They did not, however, have, as I mentioned, AIDS service organizations in their neighborhoods. But for the ones who did, it was majority healthcare providers, not as many social support or educational providers. And only three people had received services from those organizations. So when we look at the implications of this, the concept of geobehavioral vulnerability makes sense. Where, again, if you live in a neighborhood where HIV is prevalent, where HIV is there, your risk may be increased, but we need to do a better job of seeing what those social and structural factors are that drive it. In your high incidence areas, how many resources are available, whether it's mental health, substance use, HIV related, or just general health? And then what do we now do once we know what some of these social and structural factors are? How can we shape policy? How can we change procedures? How can we make arguments for resource allocation so that people have access to the services that they need? And with this knowledge, if we then know what the individual social and structural factors are that drive the epidemic, we can use that to sort of contain rates in areas that are already highly affected, while also preventing the spread to some of our lower impact communities. And thank you. You may now eat after questions.